Thank you for joining us today for the Institute for Literacy and Learning's live chat conference call series. I'd like to remind everyone that today's call is being recorded. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Jan Hasbrook discussing her book, The Reading Coach. Before we start, though, I have some very important messages and housekeeping details. If you haven't done so already, please mute your phones, and please do not put your phones on hold. Second, if you have a question for Dr. Hasbrook, please email it to straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Again, the email address is straighttalklivechat@theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. No spaces. If time does not allow for all questions to be answered, all emailed questions and their answers will be mailed to everyone registered for this call in the next few days. I also encourage you to help us help you by telling us at the Institute for Literacy and Learning which topics you would like to hear about for future live chat conference calls with the experts. Dr. Jan Hasbrook will be speaking for an entire week at one of the Institute for Literacy and Learning summer conferences. You can join Dr. Hasbrook from July 9th through the 13th at Harrisburg University in downtown Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for the best practices of literacy coaching. For more information about this conference, please log on to the Institute for Literacy and Learning's website at www.theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. As an added bonus for Straight Talk Live Chat participants, you are entitled to register for the summer conferences at a special price of $999, which is one-third off of the original price of $1,500. So, mention you were on this call, and you will receive this special pricing as a bonus for joining us today. In the next few days, please check your inboxes for the next Institute for Literacy and Learning live chat conference call with researcher and author Dr. Marilyn Adams on May 22nd at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Dr. Adams, the chief research scientist for the PBS show Between the Lions and a Sesame Street consultant, will present Soliloquy Learning Reading Assistant. Join us on this call to learn the benefits of interactive read-alouds and how this groundbreaking one-on-one guided reading technology is increasing students' fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension levels at double the rate of national norms. So thank you again for joining us, and now I would like to present renowned reading researcher Dr. Jan Hasbrook speaking about literacy coaching from her book, The Reading Coach. Dr. Hasbrook?
Hello, I'm here. Glad to have this opportunity to talk with all of you today. Our goal was to share some of the key ideas from this book, The Reading Coach, to give you some additional resources and ideas for the coaching model in your various situations, as well as to invite you to the Summer Institute that we have planned. I have a lot of noise in the background at my home right now. I'm sorry about if you can hear the siren. Hopefully that will go away. The challenges of phone conferences. I am going to be talking to you today about the student-focused coach model that I have developed with Dr. Carolyn Benton. I hope that some of you were able to receive handouts for this. We did create a PowerPoint, and if you had a chance to receive those and make copies of them, that probably will facilitate your participation today. If you don't have those now, I'm certain we can figure out a way to get those to you after the fact. So I'll just go ahead and begin. I have written the book called The Reading Coach, A How-To Manual for Success, with my colleague, as I mentioned, Dr. Carolyn Benton. We brought our interest in coaching that comes from the fact that both of us, previously in our careers, moved from a role more traditionally recognized as a reading teacher, reading specialist, to one where we were asked to work with our colleagues in a different way. Now, instead of working with children so directly, we were now being asked to work with teachers. Unfortunately, in both of our cases, we received no training, no real guidance for how to do this exciting and intriguing role. So after a lot of years of doing reading coaching ourselves, as well as very thorough and careful examination of the research and doing some research ourselves, we've written the book that we both think we wished had been on the desk, our desks as we started this role, so we subtitled this book, A How-To Manual for Success. When most of us think about what reading coaches do, we think about some fairly obvious things, that such as reading coaches probably spend time going into the classroom of their colleagues, watching them teach reading lessons, and providing them some feedback. Another thing that reading coaches often get asked to do is to collect data. We are collecting data on students at times, performing assessments, doing observations, and also data sometimes on our peer colleagues, watching teachers teach and keeping some track or record of that. In general, we think of reading coaches as serving as advisors and supporters for their colleagues. And as reading coaches, that would focus in on the area of reading and literacy that could include materials, instruction, assessments, and those kinds of things. But although those are the basics that most of us would think of for the job of a reading coach, there's certainly much more than that coaches can do. The growing interest in reading coaches, it's really become a phenomenon in schools, this burgeoning role of reading coaches, is probably attributed to the understanding of the power of the role of the reading coach. The idea that coaching is, in fact, probably the highest quality of professional development. And in the area of reading, this today is so very important. We have learned so much about how to provide good reading instruction to our students. The knowledge base that we expect teachers to implement these days in the area of reading is phenomenal. The job of teaching reading is well informed by research, but most of us as professional educators know that there's a big gap between what we know that we should do and what we can always carry out in the classroom. And to bridge that gap, what we as educators have always had is professional development. We take graduate classes, we attend workshops after school, we go to summer institutes, we attend professional conferences. Those are all wonderful things and absolutely necessary. But the challenge is taking that new knowledge that we gained at a workshop or a conference or at a graduate class, taking that back to our classroom and implementing that effectively in a way that helps students. That's the gap that reading coaches are seen as being able to bridge. And that is, so coaching is, in fact, high-quality professional development, and it is being documented as high-quality because of the idea that it can be personalized, it can be individualized, and that professional development support, very importantly, can be sustained over time. Rather than a one-day or a one-hour or even a five-day workshop, that idea of sustaining that kind of support over time as teachers face the struggle, the challenge of implementing new knowledge in their classroom and best practices in their classroom. So who are these people being asked to be reading coaches? Well, we're watching across the country that this can vary a great deal. Sometimes it's the person who has some time to do this. It may be someone who is seen as having some expertise in the area of reading. We would hope that the five characteristics that we've listed here, listed on our PowerPoint, would be taken into consideration. That anybody asked to be a reading coach would be, first and foremost, a person with a certain level of experience. I personally have done some experimenting with first and second year teachers being asked to take on this role, and what we found is that for a variety of reasons that doesn't always work very well. In fact, it rarely works very well. So although at this point we don't have any recommendations for how much experience, most people seem to think that a minimum of 3 to 5 years experience would be necessary for anybody taking on this role. Another criterion, the second criterion that we have listed there, is that anybody taking this role would also have a strong knowledge base in reading to begin with, and would take on the responsibility of continuing to develop their knowledge base as they do this work. A third criterion would be that a reading coach would be someone who has had success themselves in providing reading instruction, effective reading instruction, not just someone who can, talk the talk, but also can walk the walk, especially with struggling readers. So they know what it's like to face these children and to develop lessons and to teach them and all of the realities of that. And we would hope, and probably in most cases, those three things are part of how people are selected to be a reading coach. They are experienced, they have a strong knowledge base, and they're effective teachers themselves. However, that's not enough. What we know now, and with increasing documentation from current research, we're finding that there are two other things that are necessary for a reading coach to be effective. One is what Carolyn Denton and I did not receive, which is training in how to be a reading coach. There really is a specific knowledge base and skill base for coaching that is very different from teaching children to read. So a coach should receive training in how to work with their peer colleagues to help them improve their students' reading. But even that is not enough. The last piece here that we have documented is the need for a reading coach, the absolute mandatory need for a coach to receive support for doing coaching. That support takes many forms. One of them is simply time. We're finding that a lot of people are being asked to take on the role of coach and not given nearly sufficient time to do it. Another kind of support is knowledge from an administrator about what the role of the coach is. We hear that and have documented that over and over again, that very, very smart people, even after they've received training and coaching, are put into this role and find that they can't be successful if their supervisor, their principal, does not understand coaching and really doesn't give them the kind of backup support that they need. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in our time today. If you have your PowerPoint slides, the next slide talks about different coaching models. There's lots in growing numbers of ways that people are thinking about coaching and talking about coaching. We've talked about four different models of coaching that are actually in some ways similar, but really vary from each other. One model of coaching that's very popular out in schools right now is often referred to as technical coaching. Technical coaching involves a coach focused primarily on helping their colleagues implement a new reading program or a reading program. So if your school district has adopted the Macmillan Reading Program or Open Court or Scott Forsman or any reading program, the job of the coach then would be to become highly informed in how that program works and works with their colleagues to implement that program with fidelity, to implement it well. An example of technical coaching is the work of CORE out of California. The Consortium of Reading Excellence defines their coaching model as technical coaching. A second model of coaching is what some people refer to as the problem-solving model, where the job here of a coach is to work collaboratively with a colleague to address academic behavior or social emotional concerns of students in a collaborative way. Our handouts have some references to some of these things that I'm talking about, and I've included a reference to a book by George Sugai and Jerry Tindall, and one by Tom Campworth that both document and describe in detail the problem-solving model of coaching. A third common model used in coaching in schools these days is sometimes referred to as reflective practice. the role of the coach here is to sit down with their colleague and talk and listen. Talk to their colleague, listen to their colleague, listen to a teacher talk about how they were, what they were thinking about when they planned a lesson, what they were thinking about as they delivered a lesson. And the job then of the coach is to deepen and broaden, increase the sophistication of this, their colleague's thinking and reflection about their own professional practice. Probably the most well-known version of reflective practice is the Costa and Garmston model called cognitive coaching. And a fourth model of coaching out there that is a piece of all of the other models is called peer coaching. This is a model of coaching that was studied in the 70s and continues today by Bruce Joyce and Bev Showers, who have so for now 30 years or so studied a model of peer coaching. And I want to share with you that the student-focused coaching model that we're talking about here today has aspects of all four of these models incorporated in them. But as we've taken a really close look at the research, we want to be sure that we are, in fact, doing incorporating in our model of coaching, student-focused coaching, what the research is saying. And we have found it very interesting, and if you're following again on handouts, this would be the next slide. We found it very interesting and informative that Joyce and Showers have really changed their thinking about what coaching should be. When they first started out looking at peer coaching in the 70s and 80s, they described coaching as having two teachers take turns watching each other teach and giving each other feedback afterward. And their research has now evolved so that they say that they have found it necessary and important that teachers do not give each other verbal feedback when they're coaching. They said in their research over the years that when teachers try to give each other feedback, it tends to morph into supervision and evaluation, and the whole notion of collaboration disintegrates. So instead, what they have called peer coaching, what they now call peer coaching, is two or more colleagues sitting together to plan lessons and then deliver them and then talk about, the teacher talks about what she thought she did and receives feedback that way rather than something that looks much more like supervision. And they've also come to the conclusion that this kind of coaching works only when a whole school has adopted a plan for school improvement, that you just can't drop a coach in and have them work with their colleagues and expect changes to happen. It needs to have a broader school context. Something else that we paid attention to as we developed our model is another body of research that is often overlooked in some of the coaching models, and that is, we think it was, this research was ignored because it doesn't use the term coaching. But it's a model, it's a body of research that's about 25 years old called consultation. And this research was done primarily within school psychology and special education, which is one of the reasons it's probably not that, that many people in the area of reading are not aware of that. But it is, this extensive research base looked at a triadic service delivery model that sounds and looks just like coaching, where a consultant works with a consultee to help a client, and we would simply change those terms to be the research of a coach working with a teacher to help a student. And it's all of that kind of background and knowledge and looking at other models that helped us develop our model of student-focused coaching that our book, The Reading Coach, that manual for success, is based on this model of coaching. So our definition of student-focused coaching is as follows, and then I'm going to break that down a little bit and talk about the components a bit more. But student-focused coaching, we see, is a cooperative, ideally collaborative relationship with parties mutually engaged to provide better services for students. That's the essence of student-focused coaching. But let's break that down a little bit. When we talk about mutually engaged in efforts, we have identified and talked extensively in our book about three roles of a coach: facilitator, collaborative problem solver, and teacher learner. The role of facilitator is to, as it kind of suggests there, facilitate the work that their colleagues are doing. Too often, coaching is seen as something, the role of the coach is to work with the weakest teachers, the most needy teachers, the least successful teachers. And that is very problematic. Who would want to work with a coach if the vision of the coach is that they only work with the quote-unquote bad teachers? Well, certainly that's not true. A coach should work with all teachers, because the goal is to help every student become as successful as possible. So we label the kind of work, the important job and the first job of a coach is facilitator, working to facilitate the good work that's already happening in a classroom and the good work and good achievement that's happening at the school. The second role of collaborative problem solver really looks a lot like the comes from the consultation research of a coach sitting down with one or a group of teachers to address very systematically the concerns of a student, academic or behavioral, or even social-emotional, if those kinds of concerns come up, using a very specific strategy and process that we talk about extensively in our book. And the third role for a coach is teacher-learner. This is the area of the formal professional development. This is the role of a coach in running workshops, doing the technical coaching aspect, but we use the term teacher-learner because we definitely see a coach as being most effective when they are viewed as a peer colleague of their fellow teachers, not somebody who is in any kind of way special. Their role is different, but they're not more special, more knowledgeable necessarily. In some ways they may be, but we find it very helpful for coaches to think of themselves as sometimes being someone who may teach their colleagues, but also as someone who is open to learning alongside with their colleagues and from their colleagues. But we've also mentioned the fact that coaches sometimes take on additional roles. We definitely see and strongly suggest that the role of the coach only includes facilitator, problem solver, and teacher learner. However, in the real world, coaches are sometimes asked to do other tasks. Coaches take on management roles. Coaches sometimes even take on administrative or supervisory roles, and our experience and the research tends to indicate that when coaches do take on these additional roles, that it does tend to compromise their effectiveness in the other roles as a coach, because people begin to see them as an arm of the supervisor or a vice principal or something like that. So we find, we work in the real world. We understand that there are these jobs that need to be done. What we suggest is as people develop their own coaching role in a building or a district, that they understand that when coaches are doing roles that might be managerial, supervisory, or evaluative, that they are not functioning as coaches at that time. In workshops, we often talk about coaches wearing two hats. They wear the coaching hat when they're doing the facilitator, problem solver, or collaborative planner role, or teacher-learner role, excuse me. They take that hat off and put a different hat on when they are doing these other tasks to keep that role very clear and very separate. Another part of our definition, if you're following, that would be the next slide, about better services. The theme or mantra, if you will, of student-focused coaching is the statement that coaching is about the kids. This is about our students. This is about helping every student in our school become the best leader that they possibly can be. Coaching involves partnership and relationship, but the focus needs to be on the students. The amount of time, the energy, the focus of efforts needs to be on student achievement. And that, keeping that as the focus or the goal or the key mission statement of coaching really can transform coaching from something less effective to something more effective. However, of course, in our definition, we use the term relationship because coaching is a relationship. So part of what we discuss in our book is the sometimes intricate, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes challenging process of forming and maintaining professional relationships with our colleagues. That can be a challenge at times. But again, when coaching is focused on the kids, not on whether we like each other or whether we teach the same way or whether we share the same philosophy, things go much more smoothly. Another word that we use in our definition is, or the two words are, cooperative and collaborative. And the research on coaching and consultation make it very clear that coaching is not something that can be forced on somebody, that there really needs to be a minimum level of cooperation, volunteering, if you will, to work with a coach. If it becomes mandatory, then it becomes something that functions and looks much more like supervision. Although we would start with a minimum level of basic cooperation, we hope that, and we've watched coaching evolve into something that is truly collaborative, where colleagues really value the opportunity to work together and have that sense that together they are even more beneficial as educators than working alone. So that definition is how we envision the model of coaching called student-focused coaching that we have developed and more fully describe in our book. We see four goals of coaching. Number one, of course, since student-focused coaching is all about the kids, the number one goal of coaching is to improve our students' reading skills and competence. We have a secondary goal that if there are concerns around students' literacy, that we solve them. That's a goal. It doesn't mean we can always achieve it, but that's something we work on together to address concerns. The third goal is that wonderful aspect of coaching that allows us to continue to learn, continue to get better, continue to improve our practice by working together. That's a huge strength of coaching as we've envisioned it. But the fourth goal of coaching is a real interesting one, and that has to do with this notion of prevention. A lot of people joke about this idea that if coaches really, really do their job well, then they kind of put themselves out of business. That if a teacher colleague improves their knowledge of teaching and their practice so well, that they'll need to work with a coach less and less over time. And we have certainly found that to be true. Not that coaches will ever be out of business, but that this notion of prevention is really something that we can see in schools that are using student-focused coaching. So the kinds of things that we do talk about in the book that we've listed here on the next slide include some very important aspects such as defining the role of the coach and establishing the role of the coach. We have found that this is an important thing to do up front, but also across time, just because the role of the coach is so new. We talk extensively in the book about that critical partnership of the coach working with the principal. Many, many strategies of how coaches and teachers can work together. We have some helpful hints, we hope helpful, about time management. Since the role of the coach is often much less defined by the clock than the role of a traditional teacher, most coaches seem to benefit from some kind of strategy for managing their time. We have a part of a chapter devoted to communication skills. If coaching relies on a professional relationship, we all understand that professional relationships depend on good communication. So we would assume that most people who are asked to take on the role of coach are already quite effective communicators. So this is just some ideas for deepening communication skills and talking about communication skills, especially when folks are in very challenging situations. We go into detail about the three roles of coaches that I've described to you, facilitator, collaborative problem solver, and teacher-learner. And the entire book is framed around an acronym of SAILS, which comes from the research in effective schools. This goes back to the Joyce and Showers research that say coaching is effective only when it happens in a framework of success. And SAILS provides that framework. It stands for standards is the first thing, having a focus on what we're supposed to teach. The A is for assessments, that we collect and use data for our decisions. The I, I'm sure you could guess, is for instruction. The L is for leadership, that helps keep us focused on where we need to go and provides guidance for how to get there. And the S is a school-wide commitment to doing this challenging work to teach our kids to read without excuses, acknowledging challenges, but a school-wide commitment to accepting no excuses and just working together as diligently and as hard as we can together and as effectively as we can together. So I wanted to spend a few minutes. I'm certainly going to leave time before we wrap up for questions, but just to describe some of the highlights of things that we have in our books. We do definitely acknowledge that this role is new in schools, and it's new for everyone. It's new for the coaches, it's new for our colleagues who work with us, and it's new for that other critical person in this partnership, which is the principal. So we spend some time talking about how to make this work for all of the participants. So spending some time thinking about how to clearly define the role of a coach. That would include some time to talk about the rationale for coaching. The roles. What should a coach do? What should a coach not do? What should be the coach's responsibilities? And if you're looking at the handout, the next word is written in capital letters, the limitations of the coach. Too many of us who take on the coaching role, once it's discovered how valuable that role can be, we're asked to do more and more and more and more and more, and soon we can't do the essential aspects of coaching. So all of those things need to be discussed. And because the role of the administrator is very important, we suggest, even more than suggest, we really say that for coaching to be successful, there needs to be real effort put into formulating a particular kind of working partnership between administrators and coaches. And a relationship, a professional relationship or partnership, starts with conversation. So we suggest that coaches and principals sit down and talk to each other about many things, but we have some conversation starters. That idea of discussing a rationale for coaching is a good place to start. Why do you think that coaching should exist? Why did you pull me out of my classroom as a reading specialist to make me the coach? What's the rationale? Also, the mutual understanding of coaching. That's a really important topic that many people don't get to talk about. What do you think coaching is? And as my supervisor, what I need to know that, and I'm sure you would like to know what I think coaching is before we run off and engage in this. If you've done work with coaches before, talking about that, we don't want to, of course, cross any lines about confidentiality or personnel issues, but generally that would be something worth talking about. But ultimately, we need to have a conversation about time and tasks, because that's where things will go well or not go well. There's only so much time in a day. There are many, many things we need to do. So that conversation, in fact, needs to be continuing. Once we've had those earlier warm-up conversations, a coach and a principal need to sit down and on a regular basis and talk about those issues of time and tasks. And one of the things that will come up as principals and coaches talk to each other is represented on the next slide, the next handout. The next slide on the handout is, unfortunately, a lot of coaches are perceived as almost being spies for the principal. And this tends to happen when the role of the coach is not well introduced to a school, to their colleagues. They don't really understand what the coach is doing when they show up in their classroom. And maybe they're just running back to the principal and sharing information with the principal about the quality of their teaching. We certainly don't want that to happen. So what we want is that the principals and coaches and teachers would all understand that coaching is not supervision. We talk about this quite a bit in our book. We see two basic differences between coaching and supervision. One is the purpose, and one is this notion of a volunteer nature. All good principals, of course, see part of their role as helping teachers to help students. But one thing, and that would be the role of a coach as well. However, one aspect of their role that principals have that coaches should not have is evaluation. Coaches should not evaluate teachers. They shouldn't supervise teachers with the goal of evaluation. Going back to the mantra of student-focused coaching, coaching is about kids. So the partnership between a coach and a teacher is to link arms, if you will, and look at the students and how are the students doing and how can we work together to make sure the students are doing well, and never engaging in judging or evaluating the quality of the teacher. That is the job of the principal. That is not the job of the coach. And the other difference between coaching and supervision is this notion of cooperation. We say continuously that coaches should have no more power or authority than their peer colleagues, teachers, should have. Coaches work best, they are most effective, when they are, in fact, teachers rather than administrators or quasi-administrators. We really don't have time today to go deeply into the area of confidentiality, but that is something that will come up. Those of you who are coaches may have already experienced these issues about what happens when you do see something in a classroom that you do feel the principal needs to know about. Again, we're not going to have real time to talk about that in this short time today, but it is something that we talk about in the book and definitely needs to be talked about. We do make some suggestions as well about supervising. Generally, the coaches that we work with tell us that they feel like they are inadequately supervised, that they're not receiving it's very, very rare that any coach is receiving enough specific feedback to really allow them to grow professionally in this new role. But we cast no blame in this. The reason that that's not happening very often is because in order to do that kind of supervision, the supervisor would need to have a clear understanding of what coaching is, of the role, the requirements, the skills, etc. And of course, since it's such a new role, most principals don't have that information. Without that kind of information, can't really provide specific feedback that would be valued in supervision. In order to help teachers and principals, or coaches and principals, address this, we've included a section in our book. We have included a supervisory checklist in the book, But we also included a time management tool called the 3TSR, the Teacher Time Tracking in Special Programs for Reading Teachers and Specialists, that we suggest that coaches use not every single day at all, but who would have time for that? But a way to keep general track of how they're spending their time across the day. We suggest that a coach would do this for 5 days or so across a couple of weeks, more if you'd like, but write down generally a description of what you do in 15-minute intervals for a period of a few days, and then code those, what you've done. We have some suggestions for some codes, but then summarize those activities on a bar graph. And in the book, we talk about using this bar graph two ways. One is that the coach self can look at this and say, gee, I'm spending a lot of time observing in classrooms, but I'm not having as much time as I would like, perhaps, for collaborative planning. So a coach can use this for their own personal time management. But importantly, we also suggest that this kind of summary of tasks be used to negotiate that kind of or mediate that kind of essential discussion with your supervisor about time and tasks. These are the things that I'm doing. These are the tasks that I'm doing in the amount of time I have. And asking your supervisor, is this how you'd like me to spend my task? Is this my time? Is this what I should be doing? Are there things you'd like me to do less of so that I can do more of some other things? This could also be used discussion with your colleagues about how you are spending your time as a coach. So not only do we strongly believe that data should guide our decisions about students, we also feel that we want to have data available for coaches to guide their decisions as well. So because we think that partnership between coaches and principals is so important, we devoted the last chapter of our book to principals. In fact, knowing that principals are so busy with many, many things, we wrote Chapter 10 as a letter to administrators, a note or a letter to administrators that essentially sums up the entire book. So it starts off, dear administrator, thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to read this chapter. And then the rest of Chapter 10 is a summary of the whole book. And we were hopeful, and we've had feedback that this worked that way, that if an administrator, a principal, reads Chapter 10, the coach reads more in more detail the entire book, that again, can be a way for them to have a shared vision of coaching and to have that, to begin that all-important, ongoing, continuous conversation about what coaching is and how it can be implemented effectively in your school. So just to wrap this up, I wanted to walk through the remaining chapters of the book and then leave some time for questions that, as you heard, will be emailed in, and we have some general questions as well. So chapter one of the book I've kind of covered in this discussion today. It's an overview of what coaching is, an overview of the student-focused coaching model. Chapter two is a summary of what we think a reading coach should know. It's a wonderful chapter. It was written by Carolyn Denton, so I can say that. Many people have referred to chapter two as a one chapter master's degree in reading. She did a wonderful job of summarizing key knowledge and understandings about what we should look for in effective reading instruction. Chapter three goes into more detail about how to get started, defining that role, setting up a schedule for coaching, those kinds of background issues for a coach. Chapter four is really the beginning of the skills training for a coach, deepening communication skills, and adding a tool for time management for, as I mentioned, both your personal time management decisions and also negotiating your role. Chapter 8 is providing professional development. So what I've skipped over, I can see, is chapters 5, 6, and 7, which are all devoted to the problem-solving role, going into detail about how a coach and teachers can collaboratively and systematically address academic and behavioral concerns. That's what all three of those chapters are about. Chapter 8 is really about the teacher-learner role, how to design and provide effective professional development for your colleagues. And then Chapter 9 goes to that sales idea of sustained school-wide commitment through paying attention to standards, assessments, instruction, leadership, and that sustained commitment. And the purpose and goal of all of this is to allow us a wonderful opportunity to work together. What we're trying to do out in schools is challenging and difficult, and if we can work together, we can really help most students succeed at a level that perhaps they're not achieving now. So that's how we envision coaching. That's what we've written about in our book, The Reading Coach. I am so looking forward to our time this summer, where we're going to have a whole week to go into detail and practice some of these skills and help build those collaborative relationships that make coaching effective. So I'm going to now turn it back to our moderator and see if we can address some questions.
Question number one is, what steps would you suggest as a school district to take to implement a student-focused coaching model?
Well, I would begin with looking at our students' needs. Since it's a student-focused coaching model, we need to start with where our students are. Are our students being as successful as they can be? And almost every school will come to the decision that there is more that we can do, more success that we can have. So the next thing that I would do would be to look at resources, which are always limited, but we think of resources as being time and money and people. And if the coaching model is something that seems to be valuable, looking at how we can use those resources of time, money, and people to begin thinking about coaching. Who would do this work? What kind of time can we devote a full-time person or a part-time person? If it's a part-time person, we have to be very, very clear about what their responsibilities will be. Some of the suggestions that we have in our book could help people do that. How much? Who would be the person? What kind of training would that person need in order to do coaching? How can we firmly and effectively establish that role in our building so that the teachers know the role of the coach? They understand that coaching is about kids. It's not about supervision. Doing that work would be a good way to start. And of course, I would think that reading the resources that are out there about coaching, getting your hands on that kind of material, looking at the research would also be a good way to start that implementation.
The next question is, could you describe what your summer conference in Harrisburg this summer is all about?
Yes, I'm going to say my part on that is, We're still in the planning stages of that, so we are definitely looking for the input of people that we've worked with before. We envision that my piece of the summer project is being upfront training, taking some of the topics that we've talked about here based in our book and going into a much more detail, and allowing, because of the amount of time that we would have, allowing a lot of time for people to do the work of making this model useful to their own building. We would also have some time to talk about the kinds of things that we've mentioned in Chapter 2. What does effective reading instruction look like? So optimally, I would think that the folks attending that conference in the summer, it would be lovely to have a team of people coming, not just sending people who would be the coach, but also having administrators there as well as other teacher leaders. I think a leadership team would be a wonderful way to participate in that conference this summer.
The next question is, how much support should my reading coach receive to advance in these practices, and where can I find this support?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think that we're developing that kind of repertoire of resources for supporting coaches and the models of coaching. I'm watching universities across the country begin to pay attention to the fact that coaches, the coaching model is being implemented across the country. There are folks that do trainings. Carolyn Benton and I do trainings at district level, state level, on coaching. We are working with the publisher of our book, Sopris West, to develop a train the trainers model. We are working on some of that right now, and we hope eventually to have a cadre of folks who can train in the student-focused coaching model. The folks who work with the Institute of Literacy and Learning, the consultants in step-by-step learning, have worked with us as well and can be a wonderful resource to folks about effective reading instruction, as well as coaching, the coaching model. The letters products, another Sopris product, the materials developed by Dr. Louisa Motes can be very informative, very valuable, and they have not only materials but a cadre of trainers who can do that kind of work as well. So I think there's a growing number of resources for supporting these practices.
Dr. Hasbrook, I just got this question in follow-up to the previous conference question. Would it be appropriate for administrators to go to the conference in July?
I really think it would be appropriate for the administrators. As we, coaches can't do this alone. And one of the things we have found across the country with the very large-scale statewide reading initiatives, and even No Child Left Behind and Reading First, all of those huge initiatives have tended in the past to make the same mistake over and over again, is that they focus on the teachers, and they do sometimes incredibly high-quality professional development of teachers, but then send them back to schools where the principals have not received the same information, and the principals just cannot support. They don't have the same knowledge base. They don't have the same resources. They find themselves unable to provide the absolutely necessary support to keep this new thing working. So as we put together this the Summer Institute with more detail, I definitely hope to have some things that would be specifically of value to administrators, as well as specifically valuable to a team of people, a coach, an administrator, and possibly some teacher leaders who would come to learn about this model, because they are a critical piece in this as well.
Okay, thank you. And we have one more question. The question is, I noticed the roles of coaches noted on slide number 10 are facilitator, collaborative problem solver, teacher slash learner. I don't see, quote, number cruncher, when in reality the greatest percentage of my time seems to be spent there. How can I change this?
Oh, that's a very good question. And how you can change that, I mean, the first thing I would say is any individual coach doesn't have the power to change their jobs outside of collaboration with their administrator. That's why that is so important. So I would think right away it would be to document that. We need to make our professional decisions based on data. So here's a coach who's spending lots of time crunching numbers. I assume that's student assessment data. And that's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing that we have that kind of information. It does take time to crunch those numbers and organize those numbers. We would actually put that to a certain extent under the role of facilitator, that in order to do the effective work of a school, that somebody needs to help move that process along. But if the amount of time spent is cutting into the other valuable things that a coach can do, first we need to document that. We're not going to make good collaborative professional decisions if a coach simply walks into their principal's office and says, I'm just spending too much time, this is not what I want to do. Let's document that by using some kind of process like I briefly described today. What are you doing? And then taking that in a summary form, say a bar graph, into a principal, making an appointment with your principal to have this discussion and say, I need your help. You're my supervisor. I need your support in helping me decide, make the decision about how the role of the coach, the time should be distributed across what tasks. So I really think that that's, this is not an uncommon concern of coaches. It is nearly the number one concern of coaches, is the time they are being asked to do all the different tasks. So that's what I would say. First of all, collect data on how you're spending your time. Summarize that data. Have a conversation with your administrator and see if you can make some collaborative decisions about it. But number crunching is a challenge, and distributing that job across people, getting a system down so teachers can do some of their own number crunching. There are various ways that I've seen districts approach that.
Thank you everyone for joining us today. I again would like to remind you about the Institute for Literacy and Learning summer conferences. We are offering the best practices of literacy coaching with Dr. Jan Hasbrook from July 9th through 13th at Harrisburg University, and the best practices of teaching reading by Dr. Louisa Motz from June 25th through 29th at the Penn Stater in State College, Pennsylvania. And as a bonus to you for calling in today to today's conference call, mention that you're a Straight Talk live chat call participant and receive special pricing of $999, which is one-third off of the enrollment price of $1,500 when you register for this conference at www.theinstituteforliteracyandlearning.org. Please keep in mind that next month's Straight Talk live chat is with Dr. Marilyn Adams on May 22nd at 2 o'clock. And also keep in mind that the Institute for Literacy and Learning is offering literacy grants. Lehigh University is partnering with the Institute to evaluate school districts' current literacy programs by going into schools, evaluating test scores, talking with administrators and teachers to find out what best practices of reading research are in place and what best practices are not in place. They then make recommendations on how to improve reading performance in schools. The approximate value of the grant is around $6,000, and I encourage all of you to take advantage of this opportunity and apply. And you can download a grant at the Institute's website. Thank you again, Dr. Hasbrook, for spending your time with us today and helping us understand how to save more children from reading failure. Could everyone please join me in unmuting your phones and giving Dr. Hasbrook a round of applause? Thank you so much, Dr. Hasbrook. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you so much.